OSHA. Hello everyone. So we have a great honor to receive Kimberly Crenshaw today. Of the World Social Forum. We're going to have a very full program so that you should go in and take a look at. There are going to be lots of interesting things happening. We're going to say a word about that a little bit later. I would like to also greet the people that are online. We have a lot of people that are with us from many countries, especially well the US, but also from abroad. I would like to so thank them for being here with us. So I would like to remind that in the context of the World Social Forum of Intersections, what we're trying to do here is to reflect about systemic change. So how do we walk towards systemic change? Using, of course, the frame of intersectionality and recognizing all the how the discriminations cross, especially when we talk about race, about gender. We have the great honor to receive Kimberly Crenshaw, that is going to be exchanging with us today. So just to explain you a little bit what is going to happen in the following minutes, we're going to have a conversation, actually. And then there are some questions that we have received. We won't have time, sadly, for many questions. You know, I guess you would have a lot of questions to ask, but we have some questions that have been selected and some people in the public that are going to be exchanging. And actually, it's going to be more an exchange than a Q&A. So yes, and this should last a little bit more than an hour because Professor Crenshaw has another activity. Actually, she has to be in Boston, so she will run. Okay, so I'll let Shali start with the first introduction.
Professor Crenshaw is a law professor at UCLA and Columbia University. She's best known for popularizing the concept of intersectionality. She co-founded Critical Race Theory, and she co-directs the African American Policy Forum. She's also the host of the podcast Intersectionality Matter. Thank you. Thanks for being here. To the concept of intersectionality. So what are the origins of intersectionality and its expansion taking in account the experience of black women and beyond?
Good morning, bonjour. So first of all, let me just thank you for being willing to have this conversation in the only language that the American educational system hit me with, and that is English. And so I realize that it is a burden, and I very much appreciate it. I also want to thank you for giving me this wonderful opportunity to build community with so many people across North America, across the world. I think we cannot overestimate how important these moments are, particularly in this moment when the news every day brings another story about what we are losing in the broader public arena. So this is an important opportunity for me. I am as thrilled to be here as your welcome suggests that you're thrilled to be here. So I'm really happy for this conversation. And I'm also happy to answer this question because so much of the conversation happening specifically in the United States about intersectionality, but my hunch is it's happening elsewhere, is built on distortions. I think many of the distortions are intentional distortions. I think much of the pushback against the entire agenda of the latter half of the 20th century and the first quarter of the 21st is to undermine the frameworks that have actively facilitated our ability to demand greater accountability, to demand more inclusive policies, practices, to actually create the possibilities for a true multiracial democracy. I often say that when people are trying to take something away from you, that is an indication that what that thing is valuable. Or another way that my mentor, Barbara Arnwine, always says when I call her up and, you know, I'm whining, I'm like, oh, this is something else that happened. She'd say, Kimberly, dogs don't bark at parked cars. Recognize that there is something moving, and that is what is drawing their ire and attention. So I say all that to say that intersectionality is one of those frameworks that they are barking at. It's one of those frameworks that they are trying to undermine, they are trying to distort, they are trying to take away from us and future generations. So I start there because this is contested space. These are ideas that have been reframed. So intersectionality gets talked about, disparaged as a religion, disparaged as identity politics on steroids, disparaged as an effort to reverse existing hierarchies to the detriment of single, white, cisgendered Christian men. These are all the kind of misinterpretations of intersectionality. So to be able to actually say, okay, this is what I think intersectionality is, actually is a deeply politicized moment. So thank you for that. Here's some of the preconditions for intersectionality that I think speak somewhat to the structural dimension of the work that you all are trying to do in this convening and moving into the forum next year. The condition of intersectionality's possibility was the fact that there had been a racial justice movement beginning in my context in the 60s, followed quickly by the feminist movement, and then followed by that, LGBTQ movements. The commitments that those movements represent to eliminating racial injustice, to eliminating patriarchy, to eliminating heteropatriarchy. These were all commitments that created the expectation that all of racial injustice should be included in that imperative to create racial equality. All of patriarchy and the ways that it is experienced, all of heteropatriarchy. So you start with that commitment and then ask, are these frameworks robust enough to address the ways that these inequalities play out in the lives of people who are subject to all of these isms. That's a complicated way of saying, when I was a graduate student, I was really interested in finding out whether some of the experiences that I was having as an activist in a racial justice context or in a feminist context, or as a student activist, really pressing my law school to hire more people who looked like me. And what I would get back is, well, that issue needs to be handled by the Women's Law Association, or that issue needs to be handled by the Black Students Law Association. And then the school on top of it would often say, well, we have a committee that's dealing with women, but that committee isn't dealing with women of color. And we have a committee that's dealing with people of color, but that committee isn't dealing with women of color. So it was astonishing to me that the very structure of the intervention, like, they weren't saying we don't want women here, they're not saying they don't want people of color here, they certainly weren't saying we don't want women of color, but the structure that they put in place to realize those imperatives was not intersectional. Now, I didn't have that word for it, but there was an absence. There was something missing in the way they were thinking about the problem. So I was really curious about, where does this absence come from? Is it replicated in other institutions, and can we find it in the law? So I did what, you know, every student often likes to do. I went to get another degree so I could think about it. So after I graduated, I went to University of Wisconsin, and I was reading, because I wanted to find how the law was thinking about this problem. So lo and behold, I stumbled across a case that I talk about a lot. It's DeGraffenried versus General Motors, and it was a case where Black women were basically saying, General Motors, you're discriminating against us, not just as Black people and not just as women, but you are discriminating against us as Black women. That was their claim. Now, step back. One would think that because our anti-discrimination law, which is Title VII, protects you against race discrimination, protects you against gender discrimination, one would think that it would protect you against both of those things when they happen at the same time. That would be logical, right? It wasn't so logical to courts. They just didn't seem to get it. So what they would say is, well, you can't prove race discrimination because General Motors does hire Black people. And you can't prove gender discrimination because General Motors hires women. Now, of course, what Emma DeGraffenried was saying is the Black people that you hired are women, and the women that you hired are not Black. So I should be able to make a claim of compound discrimination. And here's where it really got funky, right? Because what the court said was, if we allow you to put these two claims together, we're giving you preferential treatment. We're allowing you two swings at the bat, two bites at the apple. And we don't allow men of color to do that, and we don't allow white women to do that, so if we allow you to do that, then you're getting something that no one else gets. Now, of course, the reality was no one needed to put these two causes of action together to basically tell a story of discrimination. So what the court was basically saying is, because you're the only people that need this, for us to give it to you is to give you preferential treatment. So that just blew my mind. I thought, okay, this is an obvious gap, but these are really smart people, supposedly. So we need something remedial. And in English, you know, remedial is both something to remedy the situation, and also, you guys aren't doing so well with this, so we need some intervention to help you see more clearly what you obviously are missing. So intersectionality was just a use of a metaphor. I'm a very visual thinker, so in my view, what was happening was there was a race sort of set of policies and practices, and that was like one axis of inequality. And then there was a gender axis of equality. Things were happening on, you know, sort of both axes. But what was happening to Emma de Graffenried was the overlapping dimension of these axes. So she was situated in a way where she was subject to both the consequences of the race policy and the consequence of the gender policy, and they weren't able to see it. So the metaphor was like, look, you cross intersections every day on your way to work, whatever you do. Think about what I'm trying to say as that intersection. Think about what Emma de Graffenried is trying to say as an intersectional injustice, a vulnerability that she and other people similarly situated are experiencing. And in this moment, Title VII anti-discrimination law applies to them as much as it applies to anyone else. So your judgment is more or less like, you know, there's an accident, someone's harmed, the ambulance comes, we can't tell whether it's race or gender, it looks like it's both, so we don't, you're not identified against this problem. That's ridiculous. So that was the point of intersectionality, to give you sort of a mental picture so that the failure to see what is happening to people who are multiply situated is more clear. Now, it grew from the law. So intersectionality is not just about discrimination. It's not just about law. It's not just about black women. It's not just about what's happening in North America. It is now a far more expansive idea. It grew out of this particular moment. It grew out of these particular cases. But as frameworks and knowledge can be more broadly utilized in other moments, intersectionality has become that framework that allows people to tell stories that without that concept they were unable to tell.
Thank you a lot. That is so insightful. I think it is so important to remind, you know, ourselves what we are talking about, because indeed, intersectionality has been used in many sauces, as we say in French. For sure, there are sometimes the fact that race is being also erased from intersectionality. I feel that we had a very interesting conversation yesterday, and I believe it is so, so important to recall that this. So thank you also for, I think the metaphor is so, it's speaking a lot. How can we build like open narratives? How can we go towards pictures that allow us to understand the reality that is painful, really painful for people, and that has been anchored in history, colonial history, patriarchal history, that is lived every day by people, and that is projected, and we are seeing how black kids and black girls are killed, also black indigenous women are killed, also still today disappeared. So this is so insightful. Thank you again for this intervention. So we were speaking yesterday also about the fact that that intersectionality has traveled around the world a lot and has been interpreted in different ways also. You were telling, we will say, funny story yesterday. I mean, it's better laugh about it than cry. But that you were in France and there were people, I think it was in France or Germany, and people were saying, okay, how many intersections there are? Are there 18 intersections or 7? No, it's 6 or whatever. So I would like to ask you a little bit more about how have you seen the term, the concept of intersectionality travel around the world?
Sort of like a migrant without a passport, right? it gets interrupted at the border and deeply interrogated, and sometimes turn around and sit home. started by backtracking just a bit and picking up something that you said leading into the question, because, you know, the next generation of intersectional analysis that I engaged in after the discrimination case was about violence. It was about violence against women, and in particular, I was deeply troubled by the fact that anti-racism, when it came to violence, tended to focus pretty exclusively on men of color. And anti-violence, when it came to women, was framed as a colorblind vulnerability. So there wasn't a specifically gender-inclusive analysis of vulnerability to violence on the racial justice side of the movement, and there certainly wasn't an ability to talk about how race and other markers of vulnerability actually shape the experience of women to violence. And so I was writing about like this in the 80s when the movement was actually peaking in certain ways, and there was an effort to create a political campaign around the vulnerability of women to violence. And one of the things that I was interested in was, so what can we learn from the data about the vulnerability of women of color to intimate partner violence? Now, I went to, I was in Los Angeles, and I was, you know, starting to pull or try to get information, and I found a really bizarre sort of convergence between the racial justice community and the women's community, and that was neither one of them wanted the actual data to actually be released. And I was like, so why is this? Why would there be this convergence? Well, within the racial justice community, there was a concern that if the data showed disproportionate experiences of violence in communities of color, that would justify the stereotype that communities of color are deeply violent. And within the women's community, there was a concern that the traction that they had been making against the stereotype that violence against women is a race class problem and not a problem for all women, and especially for elite middle class women, that they would lose that traction. So there was sort of a convergence of, we don't want to talk about the intersectional dimensions of this because the story that we want to tell for both of our movements would be compromised by this information. So it kind of blew my mind to think that these two movements that tended to be kind of oppositional were agreeing on one thing. We don't want to tell your story. And then there were consequences to that. There were consequences in how rape crisis centers were funded, for example, because a lot of the rape crisis centers were funded based on the idea that the best approach is to prosecute the offender. Well, a lot of black and brown women, prosecution was like third or fourth on their list. First, they wanted to get stable. They wanted to be housed, those who were unhoused. They wanted to be able to be economically secure. They wanted space for their children. And then they might get around to figure out, what do I want to do about the sexual abuse? That could not be marked as a meaningful intervention because the framework about sexual violence and what should be done with it was pretty much limited to women who don't have those issues. The same with domestic violence. A lot of domestic violence shelters were based on an image of who the woman was who needed the intervention. So in many contexts where the women who needed the intervention were non-English speakers, and the shelter did not have resources for non-English speakers, they would turn those women away. So here's a moment again where the structure of intervention actually reproduces the vulnerability, because the conception of who the object of the intervention is was non-inclusive. It was not multiracial. It was not it was not intersectional in terms of who the women were. So that basically led me to interrogate movements as much as law, and being able to trace what I call intersectional failure. When we are not being fully intersectional about how we analyze the problem, the interventions, of course, are going to leave a lot of people out. So that was sort of the work that was being done in the framework of some of the more familiar movements. And then sort of unexpectedly, intersectionality sort of jumped the national boundaries and started to travel. So the story I was saying yesterday was I got an invitation. It was a long time ago. It was 2008. To come to a conference that was framed celebrating intersectionality. And I thought, okay, that's cool, that's great. I kind of want to know how other people are talking about intersectionality outside of the United States context. So, yay, let's go. So I went to this conference, and sometime between the time that I accepted the invitation and showed up, the title had acquired a question mark. So my invitation was celebrating intersectionality, period. The conference was celebrating intersectionality. And so there I am giving this talk, so literally under a question mark, right? I didn't volunteer to go over, you know, it wasn't like, please, you know, if you like intersection, fine, use it. It wasn't my agenda to promote it. So the question mark just kind of felt a little strange. And that's what led to the debate that I shared with you yesterday, because the panel after my talk was going to the mat. I mean, they were really fighting about how many intersections there are. And one was like, there are exactly 17. And someone else was, no, there are 11 intersections, and here they are. And I literally didn't know what they were talking about. Why they were talking that way. I didn't know, how do you go about counting intersections in the abstract? This isn't an abstraction. This isn't like a predictive kind of grand social theory. It is a tool, it is a prism, it's a way of looking at a context of inequality and asking what are all of the contributing factors to it that we have to incorporate in our analysis in order to figure out how to intervene effectively. So it was sort of a moment when I realized that ideas can travel without their intentionality. And when it does cross borders, and in this moment, the most significant border wasn't necessarily a national one, it was a disciplinary one. Because in the context in which this debate was happening, it seemed to me that to count as knowledge, the theme or the framework had to have a particular a set of attributes. It needed to be predictive, it needed to, you know, engage Habermas and Durkheim, right? It needed to have what gets framed as a disciplinary sort of set of credentials. And those credentials were not what they needed them to be in order to be able to say, this is what we're bringing to the theoretical party. So my goal in intersectionality was to actually do real work on the ground. Their goal in intersectionality was to create grand theory that may or may not do real work on the ground. So there are sometimes divisions in how ideas get taken up. So my talking about intersectionality might not be the same, you know, as a social theorist in Germany or as a political theorist in France. There are many stories about that I can tell you as well. So what I've learned in the moment is that many times as ideas travel, the context out of which they were articulated don't always travel along with it. And when that happens, the ideas are subject to re-articulation. Sometimes that's not a bad thing. I mean, people can pick it up and use it in different contexts. But sometimes it is problematic when the context in which it is traveling is one in which the hierarchies in those spaces are not seen as legitimate areas of inquiry. So what I thought was happening as intersectionality was traveling through Europe in particular was that the resistance to talking about racialized hierarchies was actually distorting what intersectionality was doing. And it was framed as, well, we don't have that problem here. The proof that was offered to explain why we don't have that problem here was that there wasn't any literature that was produced to show that we have that problem here. Well, literatures come from the people who are admitted in the institutions to do that. So the absence of the literature wasn't the absence of the problem, it was actually proof of the problem. Discovery. I will add this last little tidbit. I was perplexed, flummoxed. I didn't know what to make of it until we had a meeting in the ladies' room, right? So I went into the bathroom, and there were probably like six black women in this entire conference, and they all followed me. We had a little meeting in the room, and we just kind of laid it out, and it was like, get what's going on. There were just so few in the academy so that their ability to mark what the realities were was undermined. So it gave me a really important sort of checkup on just because people are using the language doesn't mean they're actually elevating the elements of intersectionality that might actually be playing out in this particular space.
And violence and how it is important in that way. But to go in a more hopeful and positive way, if I can say, what role do you think intersectional thinking can play in resisting rising authoritarianism, both in the US and also in global context?
Ooh, that is the question of the hour, isn't it? I have so many thoughts about this, and that some of them are half-formed, some of them are hopeful, some of them are screams of despair. So, first of all, I think that we need to be better able to tell the story of how we got to this moment in which the democratic-oriented imperatives of the last 75 years have been undermined and are on the verge of collapse over a very short period of time. Like, how did it happen? What are the conditions of its possibility? And here is where, again, I bring intersectional failure into the story. So, again, I'm going to tell you a story from the U.S. side of it. Your neighbors to the south who have decided that Canada would be a great 51st state. I have no words other than I'm sorry. So sorry. But some of those conditions of possibility have been around for longer than our pundits are willing to say. You know, for some people, this is like, you know, the Los Angeles fires. It just happened instantly and just burnt up everything. In fact, the kindling, the dried out spaces that were scorched had been there for a while, waiting for the particular spark in order for the disaster to happen. So what are some of the things that have been there for a while? Well, one of the things that's been there for a while has been the resistance to telling the stories of structural inequality. I'm a lawyer, so I focus on the ways that Supreme Court cases and the law embrace this idea that unless you can find an individual who hates women or who hates people of color, unless you can find an evil person in the mix. The inequalities that are attended to the various institutions that we live in are just there. They don't represent or reflect any infirmity that needs to be addressed. That in turn reinforces the idea that many MAGA people have, that equality, diversity, equity, and inclusion, all of these ideas are actually reverse discrimination. Because if you can't talk about how institutions like the law, public health, policing, if you can't talk about how they are structured in a way that predictively produces particular kinds of harms, if you don't have the language and the understanding and the history to say that this thing is not natural, this is a product of power, when you can't say that, then you can't sustain a program to intervene. Because those programs to intervene are going to be seen as reverse discrimination. It's going to be seen as woke. It's going to be seen as taking away or being inefficient. So, for example, when Trump immediately blamed DEI for the airline accident that happened, and people didn't have any way really to push back against it, It's showing how the underlying understanding of institutional forms of exclusion that diversity, equity, and inclusion are trying to address has been there. They didn't understand that. So that pushback has been going on for 40 years. Critical race theory was designed to address that. You know, to talk about how inequality is produced not just through segregation and not just through you can't come in this space, but reproduced by, okay, we're gonna define meritocracy through our own biographies. So what is meritorious to be a law professor at Harvard Law School, for example? Well, first you have to have gone to Harvard Law School or Yale. Oh, guess what? Women and people of color didn't get to go to Harvard and Yale, but we're not gonna focus on that because we're colorblind, we're gender blind. That color blindness and gender blindness allows the racism and sexism that is embedded in the meritocratic system to just go unnamed, and allows the people who are sitting there pretty thinking, I got here on my own merit. Not, I got here because I didn't have to compete against most of the population, right? So these are the conditions that when they are not interrogated, they reinforce this resentment against having to be accountable for the consequences of exclusion. The Supreme Court ends up backing all this stuff up and re-articulating anti-discrimination law so that things like, you know, structural exclusion, disparate impact, they all look like, you know, it's like the court de Graffin read. That's preferential treatment, right? So that's a condition that goes all the way back. And I want to also name that it's not just conservatives who were resistant to a deeper interrogation of institutional forms of exclusion. It was also a lot of my liberal professors who were willing to say to me when we were trying to get, you know, more people of color on the faculty, wouldn't you prefer an excellent white professor over a mediocre black one? I mean, that was their thinking. So you've got this background of belief that our society is basically okay. It doesn't need much adjustment. And when you try to adjust it, it creates this resentment, which then in turn becomes MAGA, right? It becomes, weren't things better when you didn't have to think about any of this stuff? Weren't things better when you had the, you believed that you had a right to 90% of everything before these other people came along? So that resentment is easily activated by politicians who are willing to say, I can solve this problem. I can get rid of the immigrants. I can get rid of the queer people. I can get rid of the indigenous. I can get rid of all the people that you are now having to worry about taking your place. because that place does belong to you. And we're gonna reverse what's happened over the last 75 years. That effort to create this story about when we were great, this mythical past, that is the core of fascism. That's what the great leader promises, right? I'll return you to a period of glory when, you know, the only thing you had to worry about is just, you know, getting it done. You didn't have to worry about all of these people. So the story that I try to tell is that we got to this moment because of failures to reckon with our real history, because of failures to tell people, look, what you should be worried about is not the woman who takes your job or the immigrant who moves into the neighborhood. What you should be worried about is the age-old strategy of scapegoating the other in order to make you feel better. So as long as you have some kind of hierarchy over others, you don't have to worry about the fact that, you know, climate change is basically going to kill you and your children. Or you don't have to worry about the fact that the upward distribution of resources has been greater in this last generation than we've seen over the course of history. You don't have to worry about those things because we're going to keep these people under you intact, right? So where do we get to the good part? The good part is we've seen this story before. We know what the last chapters are. Toni Morrison, I quoted her last night. She said, you know, the final solution happens in steps. It happens in stages. You go after the other. Then you erase the other's story. And then you weaponize your ability to erase their story to erase other stories. That's what's happening in the United States, right? So the solution we know is to resist the effort to erase, to resist the idea that we'll all feel better if we don't talk about that stuff, to resist the idea that, well, they're coming after you. As long as they're coming after you, I'm good. When we know that once they get done with the one group, they're coming after the next one. This is what history tells us. And the only thing that really gets in the way of us really grappling it is the belief that this stuff happened somewhere else. Well, actually, it did happen in North America, right? Isn't that what settler colonialism is about? Isn't that what enslavement is about? So when people say it can't happen here, it means that the it that they're seeing is not the racialized narratives that help constitute the space that we're in. It's sort of saying fascism is what happens to people who look like me. It's not what happens to people who don't look like me. So we have to recuperate the story of our possibilities. We have to push back against the belief that this is really big in the United States. It's anti-patriotic to tell the truth about the founding. It's anti-patriotic to tell the truth about who got what and why. It's anti-patriotic to actually demand accountability. We know the devastation of that hold. We've seen it before. So the real question is, what do we need to do collectively to strengthen our ability to push back against that erasure?
Definitely need to resist the fact that we are erased, that our history is erased, and build new narratives. Definitely, thank you for that. How do we reverse hierarchies? How do we produce power? How we take the power in the service to people that are the ones who are needing this power and are actually taking it. And we are a lot of people here taking power. There are some, I recognize many faces, and power is in the room, I can assure you. I actually want to also acknowledge the presence of some people that were at the beginning of the week in the Global Conference Against Caste in the South Asian region. It was really insightful also in terms of analysis of intersectionality from the perspective of caste and how race and gender also is crossing in that area of the world. So thank you a lot for being here. It's an honor. So how do we walk towards a true multiracial democracy? How do we take back our democracies? And what is beautiful in the term of democracy, it seems like being trashed. So how do we walk towards that? And actually, as you already know, what we're trying to do in the context of the World Social Forum of Intersections is actually building up on those narratives. There are three pillars. I would like maybe to just remind the pillars of what we're that we're using and that we're nourishing through this process for you to know also why. So there are three pillars that we are took for ourselves as being one of the responses or some of the responses to walk towards systemic change. So the first pillar is definitely intersectionality. So to recognize that race, gender, and other forms of oppressions are creating real suffering, have created real suffering, and still projecting this suffering towards the future. So this recognition is the first pillar. The second pillar is building up a narrative about how to walk and how to move forward, you know, and how to, as you were saying, produce power, you know. And this power, we believe it also to be, of course, in this recognition, but also in the fact that we need to open spaces, as this one and the forum is one of them, cross our perspectives, our cultures, our generations, our hopes, our practices, our territories, our knowledges. So spaces that open up and create intersections that are going to contribute to build this narrative, and they are going to be also nourished by the people that are leading this intersections of oppressions, you know? And so the second pillar is open up spaces of intersections towards action. And the third pillar is actually based on feminist principles. So how do we build narratives? How do we recognize? How do we acknowledge all the suffering, all this pain? And so we think that the political culture of respect of that is actually can be summarized by let's say feminisms, respect, listening, caring, loving has been also one of the pillars of what we're trying to do here, because we know already that in our democracies, even in our movements, there are lots of things that lots of acts and actions that don't go and that don't are not using and nourishing this feminist principle. So this is another principle and pillar on which we are basing our path and opening this path of hope, actually generating hope. So I would like to just try to continue the conversation with you and to ask you, what do you think about this process that we're moving forward now, and that we're trying to put in a what do you think about the intersection?
I like it.
Clearly, I think that building from what we understand to be the values of feminist organizing, what we understand to be the analytics around inequality, and what we clearly know is important to build counterinsurgency space. I think on that, I want to sort of dive in a little more on space. I was talking with my producer of Intersectionality Matters, Nicole Edwards, right over here last night. And we were talking about the importance of shared space to contest the convergence of power that we're experiencing in the here and now. And you know, our theory is that for a variety of reasons, power is A, impersonal. It flows through structures that already exist. It doesn't need to be together in order to do the things that it does. But resistance isn't, we can't phone or tweet or post resistance in. Our ability to take back these democracies, it is not going to happen in 44 characters. It's not going to happen, you know, I love social media, kind of. But I think nothing can substitute the importance of shared space. Nothing can make up for the ways in which our collective struggle got us to these places. I mean, struggle against oppression isn't just a headspace. It's embodied. It's material. And so how we got into this conversation, we have a special series on called The United States of Amnesia, and it's telling the story of critical race theory. And Mari Matsudo, my partner in critical race theory, tells a story about how when we initially came together in a convent, actually, to talk about what we all had in common. And out of that conversation came the idea that actually we're part of an intellectual political movement, and we gave it a name. But what she said was it wasn't just about sharing ideas, it was getting to know each other, right? Knowing, you know, who are the people who actually are artists? Who are the people who are grumpy in the morning? Who are the people, you know, who are able to sustain us in other ways? A movement is based, is made up of people with a variety of skills who are willing to share those capacities in a way to build something that's greater than the sum of its parts. That's what created movements for change. And it just can't be replicated when we're not sharing space, right? That's just not, you can't have a political debate with your thumbs, right? And I think that is part of the immediate history that we have to recuperate, right? We have to tell the story about how it happened, how the platforms were built, how we got to this. And our story told from the ground is gonna be different from the story that's told from the top down. Because the story told from the top down is, well, things were never that bad anyway. And we were always a democracy, and we were always gonna fix some of the bad stuff, and we're pretty much done. That's the story from the top, right? So it involves people actually being concrete. How did we go about challenging these exclusions? How did we go about naming this particular kind of oppression? How did we go about finding the overlap between this community and that? That's not gonna happen in the spaces that exist that are virtual. It's gotta be real, it's gotta be live, it's gotta be personal. So I'm here because that's what I'm committed to. So when you invited me to here, I was like, ooh, can we squeeze it in between Virginia and Boston? And that's why we're here.
Yeah, I think people can meet and to create dialogues between different communities, different collectives, different person, different point of views. So having your opinion about it is really really appreciated. Thank you so much. We were talking earlier before about how intersectionality has traveled around the world and how its meaning can change. So in your opinion, how can we now reactivate the subversive potential of intersectionality that was here at the first place in contexts where it's both celebrated and neutralized?
You know, so I always tell people, look, how-to questions are not always my forte because I'm trying to figure out the same thing. You know, so these are moments where I think we start the story like, here's an idea, or what do you think of that? But we have to build that capacity with the talent and the vision that's in the room. So, you know, I'll start, but I think this is a good point to get other people to help us think through that. So my orientation is to do what I did with you just now, like historicize. You know, how did we get here? Or how did this thing that we see as deeply unjust and unequal become normalized so much that we actually have to fight in order to get people to see it as a problem, right? So I think the main thing against us is the ability of people to accept things that they see as givens. And rather than as constructed. And so a lot of our work is to deconstruct that, to challenge that. There is no natural reason for inequalities in our world. That shouldn't be a controversial idea, but guess what? It is a controversial idea. I'll give you this side note. So we just did, my organization, AAPF, we just did an action in Washington, D.C. on May 3rd. For the last 3 years, it's been a Freedom to Learn Day. And we have identified the attack on literacy, censorship, as one of the key possibilities for fascist control, right? Take away people's ability to critically engage the terms and the world around them, you take away their ability to resist. And so that's why every May 3rd we've done a big action. This year our action was in Washington, D.C. We were contesting Trump's attack on the African American Museum of History and Culture. So he basically doesn't like the fact that this museum actually tells the story of enslavement, tells the story of how enslavement was a condition of possibility for the United States and its wealth and continuing dominance across many, many planes. He doesn't like that story. He wants that to be erased. If you erase the story, you erase the imperative to continue to address the consequences of that story. Now, we've been telling people this for a very long time, but the actual fingerprints of what he wants to do is in the executive order attacking museums. There is a piece in that executive order in which he says the real problem is this so-called idea of racial construction. Okay, so we all accept the idea that race, gender, class, these are all social constructs, right? What is at stake when you want to push back against that? When you want to say that the problem is that race is, the problem is us saying race is a construct, what you're saying is race is natural. And when you're saying race is natural, you're basically saying racial inequality is natural. And when you're saying racial inequality is natural, you're saying addressing that is unnatural, right? So the entire point of attacking these ideas is to reinforce the idea that the status quo is defensible. And that efforts to disrupt that status quo, that's the problem. That's effectively what the attack on wokeism is, right? That's what it really comes down to. Actually saying our status quo, our hierarchies, the entire infrastructure from human rights to civil rights, all of that stuff is a problem, and we're gonna have a name for it, and it's woke. And everybody is gonna understand when we say woke, we should say no, right? That's their chant, you know? I mean, look around. You ask people, well, what actually is woke? They can't tell you. It's just an instinct. You know, we think you're trying to change stuff and we don't like it, right? So at the end of the day, this stuff is about resisting the effort to problematize interventions that are meant to advance the idea that the inequalities that we have around us are not natural. I think those are the kind of projects, you know, those are the kind of unpacking what is in front of people. And, you know, it's hard because people are used to receiving information in 20-second sound bites. I got to figure out if I can condense the story about racial construction and why he wants to get rid of it in 20 seconds. Maybe you guys can help me. But this is the kind of work that we have to be able to do at all kind of levels, from the dinner table with our family, to, you know, the classes we are in, to the organizations we are in, really reverse the inoculation against empathy, against historicizing, that this anti-woke, you know, juggernaut is producing. So that's the little piece that I do. And, you know, obviously we all have the issue that we're most we have the greatest expertise in. I like this story, and my team is gonna roll their eyes, but I tell it all the time. It's like, I love the metaphor of the guy who says he can feed a starving village with a stone in a pot. You know, and he goes in the village and he says, I can create magic, I can feed you all, just give me a pot, I'm putting this stone in it, we're gonna boil and boil and boil it, and all while he's doing it, he said, you know, this is great, this is gonna be wonderful, but if I can just get a few potatoes, and the people who are hoarding the potatoes go, okay, we'll put it in, if I can just get a carrot, if I can just get an onion, if I can just get a bone. And by the end of the day, the village has managed to feed itself, not by hoarding what it has, but bringing what it has into the pot. If the pot is collective knowledge, if the pot is capacity to understand the terms of the lives that we're living, if the pot is ability to collectivize and push back, if the pot is, we will learn to move together even despite the places where we might differ. If that is the pot, then it is within our control to actually create a more nourishing understanding of the situation. And if we're nourished, then we're better able to move. If we're not nourished, we are not able to move in a way that actually shifts the terms of the current condition. So that's the piece that I bring. It ain't everything. And I never said and never believe it is. But I figure if I can draw the piece of the elephant that I can see, and you can draw the piece of the elephant you can see, we're more likely to be able to grapple with this monster in a way that actually bears some possibility of success.
Couldn't agree more.
thank you a lot for that. So I had actually, one more question, but I would like also to invite some people to just put their grain of sel.
Do you say that in English?
grain of salt, let's say. because these are very, very interesting women that I've asked also to bring a little bit of their perspectives, you know. But just first to nourish again a little bit the conversation, I wanted to say, of course, that we're witnessing alarming rollbacks of fundamental rights, so that is not something we didn't know. But the question, and actually is maybe a question for all of us, you know, how can we sustain truly intersectional collective resistance?
And what levers can we activate to counter fragmentation within our struggles?
And this is my radio. When you're coordinating at the same time and animating, this is what happens.
So how can we counter the fragmentation of our struggles while remaining mindful of the power dynamics within our own struggles and movements? So before letting you maybe reflect a little bit about that, maybe I would like to I would take this mic. It would be easier for
check. Too hard.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for this conversation. English is not my first language, so please feel free to ask me again to repeat myself. It's okay, it's more than okay. Et merci au forum d'avoir organisé cet espace, parce que je crois que cette conversation, il y en a beaucoup qui l'attendaient, donc merci beaucoup. So I'd like to raise a question about...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm Nen Denen. So I have a lot of hats. So I'm the board of the Conseil des Montréalais. It's a consultative instance of Montreal City, a feminist one. And I also have my own company called La Maison Turquoise. So you will understand later what we are gonna what we want to address. So I dedicated my last 15 years to implement the intersectional framework in feminist organization and in women's group, and I feel like drained. it has been like wonderful 15 years, but also really violent, and I know that a lot of people here in the room has the same experience as me, like women of color also, and black women. And I noticed like a gap between the theoretical approach and the practical, and how we implement that in practice, and really in feminist movements and women groups. And I often see like the race is like an add-on. Like every identity or social characteristic, and we tell ourselves that it's an abstract concept and it's not practiced and it's intellectual. But when we experience it, it's not. It's not abstract. We live with this intersection. So how, what are your thoughts on what the widening of our intersectionality in white predominant sector, like in feminist group?
Thank you for that.
So we're going to take just two more interventions very fast. Actually, we already have two persons. I'm so sorry. I know everyone would like to ask, and I already asked a few persons. This is a very hard job I am having here because we have to let her go to the airport. So very, very fast. I will pass that right here. I thought we would have a little bit more time. I'm so sorry about that. So very fast.
Hi, my name is Victoire. I'm a student here at UCAM in sociology. I'm not an English speaker, but I'll try my best. As a sociology student, as a social worker, not a social worker, but I don't have the right title in English, and a person type a baby researcher, I want to know your framework. Was such a great part to social science, to sociology. It changed life, it changed how we see things, it changed how we write on things. I'm wondering how do you think, what is gonna be the next big thing in social science? What do you think is gonna be the next big theory intersectionality and how we can help to bring it on. So it was my question.
Wow.
Just thank you for that. And maybe just some last intervention, I'm sorry for everyone that wanted to ask questions.
Also, thank you very much.
You want to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Yolande Pierre, Vice President of Human Commission Rights in Quebec. So it's a great moment. This is my best moment for the year. So thank you for being here with us. Conversation with us. And I think my question is how en fait c'est comment le prisme, how intersectionality could be more considered into policy conception and policy maker. And I think it's very important because you said that the intersectionality helps us to have a better understanding of inequalities, racial inequalities, but gender inequalities. So how could government, public sector could have these prisma, ce prisme de d'analyse? Because we are doing that in the Commission Human Rights. We have the intersectionality into our studies, but also in our, les plaintes, the complaint that we receive also at the Commission. So we have always, we put in the center of our analysis the intersectionality. But I think there's a more there's a place for government and public sector to make sure that intersectionality is more considered in the analysis and also the policy for respond to the inequalities in the society. So thank you. I hope my my question is clear. But so thank you again, and thank you to Carmita for.
You know, the organization of this conversation. Thank you very much. You know, it just really amazes me when people say, my English is not good. And then, I mean, you don't want to hear, like, bad French. Right? I couldn't even say that in French, right? So, again, thank you all for engaging with me. I'll start with the quickest thing. The next big thing, of course, I have no idea what that would be, but I do think that we must grapple with artificial intelligence.
Yes.
I think we must grapple with algorithmic control over every aspect of our lives. I think we have to grapple with the fact that the algorithmic world that is being created is based on underlying material reality that reflects all the things that we've been talking about up until this moment, without the fingerprints of all the things that we've been talking about in this moment. So when our lives are being dictated by data that's drawn from a world that is deeply unequal, we have a future of more of that unless we can figure out how to grapple with that. So, you know, it's clear that all technology is not progressive. It's clear that technological innovation often builds on the underlying inequalities that exist. I mean, for me, the clearest example that I have is, in the United States during enslavement, the belief was that the cotton gin was going to spell the end of enslavement because you didn't need slave labor as much as you did before, and it had the opposite effect. The market grew exponentially because now there was a technology that allowed that labor to actually be more productive. I think we have to always ask the question whether new technologies are just going to exacerbate pre-existing inequalities, or are we able to harness them in order to do the work that they can be made to do with the right values in place. So that's the short of it, and I could be totally wrong about what's gonna happen, but that's at least what I'm thinking about a lot. How to deal with the whitening of intersectionality. I guess the same thing I just said about technology applies here. You know, there are underlying values and hierarchies. And as I was telling in my story about, you know, the traveling of intersectionality, if one is empowered to take what one wants of something that's valuable and discard the parts that they don't like, then it is going to produce a whitening. It's going to, the thing that is being absorbed is going to reflect the power dynamic that already exists. So as I told in my story, part of the resistance to that is to take on the arguments that were made to normalize the whitening by the claim that, well, there is no race here. There is no race here because you are able to ignore it and you have the power to reproduce the conditions that created the absence around it. So I think always attending to the underlying preconditions and being able to name it, being able to describe it, to plot it, to describe it, I think those are the moves that happen. Now, you know, the downside is that just because an idea grew out of the effort to interrogate whiteness or patriarchy doesn't mean that it always is going to have that dimension, because ideas are only as powerful as the people who are choosing to use it. So I often say, you know, people will say, well, does intersectionality do this or does intersectionality do that? And I say, you know, I'm going to date myself right now. So when I grew up, I used to watch the show called The Flintstones. And all of their appliances were like animals and stuff. And so the dishwasher was a dinosaur. And, you know, they're like, the dinosaur is like, but I don't do windows, right? And sometimes I think people think intersectionality is like that. It's a thing that does some things and doesn't do other things. And I'm like, no, it's an apparatus. And it does what people use it to do. Sometimes I hope that it's helpful to advance the underlying objectives that people have. I know sometimes it's used to reverse some of the values that we all have. So it's not anything inherent in intersectionality. It's how people mobilize the tool. And I guess that's also, you know, what I want to bring back to you. I'm really interested, and it's one of the reasons I love these kind of conversations, of learning what it is people have been using intersectionality to do. There has not been an effort to actually create a library of strategies, policy integrations that intentionally adapt intersectionality to do the work that different institutions want to do. So I'm really keen to know more about, so how has the commission, you know, integrated intersectionality, you know, in the work, and what are the conditions for expanding that and making it a more robust, you know, sort of a presence? I will say, I guess, one word of observation / caution. I think we do have to deal with the pushback against using intersectionality, because I do think that, you know, when people are asking the other question, like, okay, we know what the sexism in this is, but do we know, you know, what the racism is in this? Do we know what the transphobia is in this? Always asking that other question is the predicate for developing an intersectional set of policies to address whatever the issue is. So constantly asking and knowing that no analysis is complete. We can't assume that it's complete. I think people actually have the capacity to do that, right? I think where we're challenged is being able to push back against those who are saying, you're taking us down the road of identity politics. You're taking us through to more division rather than, you know, effective articulation of universal values. I think the struggle now is against the political misrepresentation of attending to inequalities as identitarian. That's what we have to be prepared to speak back against. The moves that I've been making, you know, since the election is that, you know, if you are really concerned about identity politics, what else explains the fact that a 34 felony indicted person who says he wants to undermine democracy, who mimics fellatio on a mic, who spends the last 2 weeks of his campaign dancing to Pavarotti and the Village People, what else can explain how he could get elected? And any one of those things that Kamala Harris done would have spelled the end of her career. If that's not identity politics, right, I don't know what is. So being able to reframe existing dynamics of power as the real identity politics, that's identity politics on steroids, accounting for inequalities that visit upon people based on their historical identities. That's not identity politics on steroids. That is what a multiracial democracy demands of us. So we need to be able to firmly push back against these ideas that wokeism is the problem. Being asleep in this moment of retrenchment is the problem, and I don't want to be. I want to be woke during this moment, and I hope you all do too.
Aussi, juste le point de vue de quoi les gens partent.